General Conference 2020, delayed until April and May of 2024, has now happened. It is time that we talk about it. Here on episode number 104 of the To Be Encouraged podcast with Bishop Julius C. Trimble. Bishop Trimble talks with me, Reverend Dr. Brad Miller, in depth about his reflections on General Conference, the decisions that were made, the spirit of the event, and the implications for the local church and for the church moving forward, with a particular eye on some of the hot-button topics which were discussed and decisions were made at General Conference, including regionalization, removal of harmful language regarding LGBTQ people, and revised social principles, as well as disaffiliation issues. We discuss all that and get more with a really important issue of the To Be Encouraged podcast with Bishop Trimble. This is the first part of several episodes we will take to explore and break down what happened at General Conference and its implications in the local church. So listen on, my friend. Listen on. You are welcome to Be Encouraged with Bishop Julius C. Trimble. Bishop Trimble is on a mission to encourage you with the love of Jesus Christ so you can rise to your highest potential. On To Be Encouraged, Bishop Trimble speaks to a discouraged world with a good word on the pandemic, racism, the environment, human sexuality, and the state of the church, with a focus on centering your life on the love of Jesus Christ. Has there ever been a more needed time for an encouraging word to our world? This is your time to rise to your greatest potential and to be encouraged with Bishop Julius C. Trimble. Hello again, good people, and welcome to Be Encouraged with Bishop Julius C. Trimble. Bishop Trimble is on a mission to help people to have encouragement in their life, and we do that here by helping people to deal with the discouraging aspects of the world in an encouraging manner. One of the things that's had ups, its ups and downs about discouragement and a little bit of encouragement over the last many years at the United Methodist Church is how do we handle General Conference? And something happened that not too long ago is we actually had a General Conference after many years of not. And so that caused some resolution to take place in many areas. There were kind of some things that were left undone that needed to be done. So, Bishop, I want to welcome you to your own podcast. And let's talk about General Conference 2024, which is really General Conference 2020. But welcome, my friend.
Thank you, Brad. It's so good to finally get a chance to talk about this postponed General Conference, the quadrennial meeting of United Methodists across the globe, which usually results in great worship, a great gathering of people from various cultures. It's almost like a United Nations of United Methodism that comes together. So it was a great gathering in Charlotte, North Carolina, a wonderful downtown convention center. So to God be the glory, and I'm looking forward to some conversation about it.
Well, let's just start with your kind of an overview of the conference. You know, there was a lot of angst about this annual conference, about this general conference, about the decisions that were before us and things of that nature. And some of it was based on past general conferences when there was some unhappy people and some really kind of, you know, really unfortunate things happened. Let's get over, before we get into some of the nitty gritty of some of the details we do want to talk about, give us an overview about the spirit of General Conference, about the sense, the vibe there. Give us a little sense of what you experienced there in that nature.
Well, it was a wonderful sense of I think, worshipful anticipation. We started with worship as we always do, but there was a sense of excitement around the possibility of becoming a post-conflict United Methodist movement. And I think that's where we left from the conference. Brad, it's the first conference I've been to. I've been going to general conferences since the year 2000. Now, keep in mind, these are meetings that take place every 4 years unless there's a special call one. And there was one in 2019. And probably about half the people who came to this conference in Charlotte probably had been at the one in St. Louis in 2019. So I'm sure those folks came wondering if there was going to be great confusion or great fights or protests on the floor and so forth. It was the first general conference I've been to where there was no protest is in the middle of the actual conference itself during the plenary session. There was some silent protest outside and in the hallways around the plight of Palestinians in Gaza. But the overall service, the spirit was there was a sense of Christian conferencing. And we knew that we had to vote on matters. The first week was legislative committees meeting to discuss all of these petitions, over 1,000 petitions that had come to General Conference because it had been postponed and there were new petitions that had to be added. But when we began in a spirit of worship. The preaching was outstanding. We heard preaching from new bishops who had been elected in 2022. We heard from the first Native American bishop elected in the United Methodist Church, from the first female bishop from the Philippines elected to preach. So we had a lot of first, and we had some outstanding preaching. The preaching and worship that focused, listen to this, Brad, on the sovereignty of God and the joy that comes when we proclaim Jesus Christ as Lord. So the spirit was great. The worship music was great. We had a traditional pipe organ and organ music. We had contemporary music. We had an African men's choir. So the worship was great. And the spirit, I think, was really great. There was some anxiety because people knew that we were going to be voting on matters that we have contested for over 50 years.
Right. You said a couple things there that I just think are notable that we note them. You talked about the sovereignty of God, the spirit of joy that was there, but also you talked about a post-conflict movement. And to me, that says we leave the conflict in the past. Doesn't mean we're not going to have differences of opinion and how we do things moving forward, but a movement means we're moving forward. Did you get the sense that we were actually moving forward, making progress, that we weren't just kind of stuck in this weird place we have been for a few years now? Where are we making progress?
I think so. And I think part of that, even for me, bishops don't get the vote. So we are either presiding or observing or encouraging and praying for the conference in real time. But I think even the vote on regionalization and the discussion and the attempt to explain it so people can understand it is a testimony that we can't do things the way we've always done them for 200 years in the United Methodist Church. The world changes at a much more rapid pace, you know this, Brad, than every 4 years. So some of the decisions I think made at this general conference acknowledge the fact that we need as a church to be more nimble and need to be more contextual. And we need to celebrate our growth in Africa and other places, but also position ourselves to be in ministry with all of the people in the various places where we find ourselves.
You mentioned nimble and contextual. I just want to make sure there is some concern going into General Conference that we may not have good representation from Africa and other places in the world and good diversity. Do you feel like we were well represented in the whole body of the church there? Were people okay with how things, the makeup of the body?
I think it was a very diverse general conference in terms of those who had voting rights. The delegations, and I say that plural, from Africa were underrepresented in terms of the numbers that they had who were eligible to be there. Some of that was because they didn't get visas or they didn't get their travel arrangements confirmed in time. In fact, there were some people still coming to General Conference after we had started. So there were additional people that came after the conference already. But I forget what the specific numbers is. Don't quote me on it. But I think there should have been at least an additional 40 delegates, if not more, from Africa who were eligible to be there and to be voting, but because of various reasons, including the time and the ability to get visas, to travel to the United States for a conference, that was prohibited from happening.
Yeah.
Some people, you know, wanted to cast the blame on the those who planned it, and others was some of it is post-pandemic realities, sure. And some of it has to do with embassies and so forth in countries
right.
where you have
well,
to go and interview.
I asked the question only because it has to do with what you're saying there, because you know, we're going to talk here very shortly about some of these, you know, very major issues, and we just didn't want to have the sense that some people were not represented on some of these contentious issues. And you know, it is what it is at this point. The decisions have been made, and you mentioned one of the key ones already there. You mentioned about regionalization. So that was a hot button issue. And before we kind of jump into what the vote was and what we did there, for our listeners, for our To Be Encouraged listeners, I know it's a little tough to do, can you help us understand the whole regionalization issue? Just give us the synopsis of it before we jump into what we did at General Conference.
Well, our church, let me see how, our church is the United Methodist Church is active and alive in various continents. So we have United Methodists in the Philippines. You have United Methodists in Europe. We have United Methodists on the continent of Africa. And we have United Methodists in the United States. In the United States, we're divided into five jurisdictions. Outside of the United States, all of those United Methodists are part of central conferences, or what we would really consider that similar to what we refer to as regional areas. So in those areas, they have certain things that they can do to adapt our book of discipline so that United Methodism can be best expressed in their cultural and country context. So they may not have to have all the various committees that we have, or they may not have to organize their ordained ministry and so forth exactly the way the United States does. So basically, regionalization would put everybody, I think, on the same organizational playing field, if you will.
Okay.
And a lot of the things we do at a four-year gathering of what we call a general worldwide meeting really focus on the United States. Almost, some have argued as much as 80% of what we debate and vote on really only impacts the United States. And so we're asking persons who come from other central conferences who are other regions of the church to come and to what we call a worldwide global gathering and vote on things. Often many of those things are dictated, driven by, say, for example, our pension plan that may apply to the churches in the U.S. or some other structural things, and the fact that there are different laws in different parts of the world. So regionalization doesn't detract from us being connectional. So like we all are connected, you know, Africa University is an example. We all are connected by the way in which we share general apportionments for our general boards and agencies. We all are connected by the work of our missionaries and deaconesses. But this would allow, regionalization would allow the United States to be a separate region, and all of the other the areas would also be a region in which we could address some things, maybe in an annual or biannual meeting, to address things that only are particular to that region, to that area. And so, jurisdictions, which we currently have, are really a vestige from segregation. Jurisdictions in the United States were created because we didn't want to have persons of color having to dictate who would be elected bishops in different regions.
So in effect, just to kind of put in another view, if General Conference is like the United Nations, everybody coming together, the United Nations does not necessarily want to be making decisions about what happened in the United States, only about our highway budget or whatever it would be. Mm-hmm. So we just need to have proper understanding of how to do church in the various contexts of the areas. So that's what my understanding of it is, basically. I kind of put it in that context. But let's talk about what we actually did, because we had an issue that needed to be addressed one way or another, at least in my opinion, needed to be addressed. So what happened at General Conference to address regionalization? How did the debate go? How did the flow go? How did we come out with this?
Well, regionalization was passed And it requires a change of our constitution, the way in which the church is constructed. So that's the first step. And if something is passed at a general conference that requires the change of the constitution of the church or the way in which the church is organized, then it then has to be voted on at every single annual conference and receive a majority vote at those annual conferences. And then it becomes the aggregate vote of those, all of those annual conferences are certified by the Council of Bishops. Then that change would actually go into place. Then the next step would have to happen. What does that mean for the way in which we would have our meetings? What does that mean for the way in which we would finally shape a worldwide book of discipline as opposed to disciplines that would apply to those regions? So the next people who may have angst about, oh, we're changing the church, just like a lot of things, Brad, it takes a lot longer than we anticipate. Right. So regionalization really would not be implemented for at least a year, if not 2 years, because some places will be able to vote on it at their annual conference at the end of 2024. But some of us will not vote on this until next year. Mm-hmm. And it will take all of the annual conferences across the denomination to approve it. And for the aggregate number of approval then to be certified by the Council of Bishops. So it's the first step.
So it has to be ratified by every annual conference or not.
Yes.
And then the aggregate, as you said, is it counted up at is that the next general conference we do that, or is it?
Before the next general conference, but it would be after all of it would come to the Council of Bishops for ratification.
Council of Bishops to affirm or.
Yeah. It won't take four more years, but it could take two more years.
Yeah. Well, and so just to kind of put it in the context of kind of a American polity, American government understanding, if you have a constitutional change in the United States Constitution, it has to be ratified by a majority of states to become a part of the Constitution.
Absolutely. Thank you, Brad.
That takes sometimes years to make a decision about that. And that's really what we're talking about here. So this is basically this issue of regionalization will be on the agenda of every annual conference, either in 24 or 25. Is that the plan?
That's the plan. And for in case of Indiana, it'd be 25. But for some conferences, or it would be later this summer or later.
So at least in theory, by the end of 25, we should have an answer in terms of the ratification votes of the various annual conferences.
Absolutely.
So we'll see. But tell me, there was just in terms of general conference that just took place, the vote to adopt or the constitutional change was that a close vote or was that a significant majority?
It was a significant majority. It was most of the just about all of the change that took place represented a significant majority. And I don't think the numbers, even those, the number of persons who were not able to attend general conference who would have been voting, I don't think it would have changed the outcome based on the numbers that were turned. So it wasn't close like in previous years. Some of the things related to the change of our book of discipline or our social principle, the items that were related to particularly human sexuality had been close votes. This was not a regionalization.
Something like 500 to 50 or something like that, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, don't ask me. I don't have the number.
But it was a significant vote. Well, let's move on to, you just touched on it there. Some of the next hot button that people really want to know about and get your opinion about, your take on, is the vote for the removal of harmful language around homosexuality, LGBTQ issues in order to be a fully inclusive church. So just walk us through that, Bishop. How did that go? How did that play out? Tell us about what happened when we talked about the removal of harmful language.
Well, some of the good things that happened actually happened on consent calendar or either came to the body when we did still have to vote on those things in the plenary session. Really resulted in a great vote for a sigh of relief and celebratory dancing and praising. Now everybody wasn't happy with the decision, but I think more were pleased that the church has moved in a direction that we can say we welcome everybody, as in one of our congregations says, with no exceptions, that all awesome. Are welcome. So this happened also with a significant majority vote. And here's something, Dr. Miller, that I'm going to use her quote when we need to get her, Reverend Dr. Ashley Bogan. General Secretary of the United Methodist Archives and History. She said after our General Conference, for the first time in 240 years, the Methodist Church no longer has discriminatory language in our United Methodist Book of Discipline.
Wow.
Praise be to God.
Yay, God. Yay, God. And just the fact that it's even it was there is just grinds you, doesn't it? It just makes you just crazy a little bit to think that that type of language has been there. And so anybody who wanted to be critical of the United Methodist Church had grounds to do it in terms of that's in our discipline. So, yeah.
Well, some people have said we've always had to keep somebody that we are, you know, that we're discriminating against or excluding. Mm-hmm. Some would say we're excluding. I mean, so if it's 240 years, we know this discussion hasn't been going on. So how could that be? Well, there was a period of time when only slaves was the issue.
Yeah.
There's a period of time in which segregation of Methodists was an issue and resulted in the establishment of Black Methodist churches. There was a period of time, Brad, when women could not be ordained.
Oh, yeah.
And that was the root. So Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said, and I think maybe I've heard you use his quote as well.
Absolutely.
But progress does not roll in on the wheels of inevitability. So to those who said, well, it seemed like a long time. I didn't know it was just 1996 that we had instituted the prohibition for pastors to perform weddings. So some of these changes, first 1972, I think the homosexuality and Christian teaching. 1984, we made it worse, or we made it more excluded. 1996. And right. In 2019, we added penalties.
Hell yeah.
Where, you know, people would be suspended or in other traditions, they say defrocked.
Yeah.
So for the first time in 240 years, we no longer have discriminatory language.
And just to be clear, all that language is gone, and it is in effect as we speak today. It was in effect as of the end of General Conference. We don't have to wait till January or anything like that.
We don't
have
to wait till Jesus comes back. So.
Well, I just, but that's, as far as I'm concerned, I know you feel similarly. That's good news in terms of us being in an inclusive church, and gives lots of churches kind of the backing in order to move forward in ministry. And you mentioned how this is kind of takes away this language, but it also, I think it's helpful to understand that in terms of its application in the local church or for local church pastors, there's still a lot of discernment for a local church pastor and church to do what they feel led to do. For a local church, you know, we talked about the enactment in 96 of banning gay weddings and so on by clergy. Well, now a clergy person can do a gay wedding.
Or not.
And that's key there. Can you say a word about its application of this decision into the local church and for local church pastors, how it's going to play out, or the opportunities for it to be applied or to be held up as a means for other decisions to be made?
I think it frees us up for really authenticity and for people to be faithful to their own conscience and their way in which they interpret their roles and responsibilities as church leaders and as local congregations. I always felt as a pastor that I had discretion over whether or not I would officiate a wedding. Now, technically, people are really getting married by the law, by the state, or, you know, they turn it into the county or the state, they're licensed. So they're coming to have a blessed ceremony in the sight of God, we often say. So I think this really frees up pastors to do ministry with all the people in their context for ministry. And if it's up there, there's some people I look back on now, and maybe I shouldn't have done the weddings. These were, you know, heterosexual couples. So I think pastors really should take seriously, and congregations. Some churches have wedding policies.
Right.
They don't do weddings in the church, and this will allow pastors as well as congregations to determine whether or not they will or will not host same gender weddings. And so I think this is a step forward, and it does not penalize anyone or make assumptions that people are going to do something that would make them violate their own conscience or their own theological.
So just to be clear, there's nothing happened here that says forces a church or a local church pastor, you must have a same gender wedding. There's nothing like that. If you don't want to do it, you don't have to, right?
That is correct. That's correct. And that's how I think it will be applied.
Yeah.
I think there have been a number of pastors who really felt carried for years, maybe, that, you know, I feel like I'm get that we have two tier we have a two-tiered system of rights and access for ministry. And so now that has been removed, so people have equal access to the services of the church, and pastors maybe feel I can be in ministry with all of my parishioners in an equal way when it comes to this particular part of our ministry.
So you think in practice for local churches and for annual conferences, for that matter, this is going to free up opportunities to do ministry to whomever they want to do. Do you think it's going to kind of take some of the constraints off? Do you think at least there's a possibility?
Yeah, I think what it does is that for United Methodists, we have had, you know, maybe I'm not assuming that people will come back in droves, but I think we've lost a lot of United Methodists who maybe grew up, were baptized in churches, and maybe they're part of the queer community. Maybe they identify as LGBTQ plus, and they gave up on the church. And you know, everybody's not necessarily gravitating to the church because they want to have a wedding, but a lot of people want to be in a church where they feel like the rights are equal across the board in places
yeah.
where it's legal. So if you're in a country where same gender wedding marriage is not legal, then this doesn't apply to churches outside the United States.
They're not being forced to. Well, let's also go a little deeper around clergy themselves, because, you know, a part of the harmful language had to do with basically not allowing LGBTQ people to be ordained. We both know that it happened, and so on and so forth. There's lots of background on that. But talk about the implications of this language being removed regarding the ordination of LGBTQ people, and what are the implications for the church in that regard?
Well, I think what it does is, I don't know if this is a good analogy or not, and maybe appropriate or inappropriate, but we think about the military where they had a no, don't ask, don't tell policy,
right,
maybe under the Clinton administration, but people can join the military and rise up in the ranks, even if they're openly gay, if they meet the requirements to serve in the military. And I think persons who have had a call from God to serve in ministry can pursue that process in the United Methodist Church if they meet the qualifications for license and ordination, and they go through the process. So being gay or openly gay does not prohibit you or exclude you from being a qualified candidate for ministry. Am I answering the question, Brad?
Oh, I think so, but I want to go a little deeper in this sense here. Do you not think that there was, in spite of many great things happening in our church, LGBTQ clergy who were part of the body often felt this kind of this, you know,
cloud.
This cloud or this hammer hanging over this, you know, the pit, I forgot the sword of Damocles over.
Okay.
If they slipped up, that they could be brought up on charges. Could go to some sort of a church trial. They could be somehow humiliated or somehow done wrong or just treated badly. And it did happen. We know it had happened. People have been sued. I know you've been involved with a couple of those things as well. But do you think maybe this will help in the sense of this cloud that is there, hopefully has been lifted, and we can now get on with ministry, and these folks who may have felt some anxiety about this situation can get on with ministry?
Absolutely. You've answered the question. Yes, I think this cloud has been lifted, and there's a need to say, you know, I'm sorry that it's taken this long. People have been hurt and harmed. We say that our general rules say do no harm. And I think what we've done is we've attempted to be Pharisaic about our laws. And so people were brought up on charges because that's what our discipline prescribed or made provision for. If persons were violating the covenant, if you will, or violating the discipline, they were subject to charges under 2702 of the Book of Discipline. So now being openly gay does not put you in danger of that. But there's I know a lot of pain, a lot of tears have been shed and will be shed because of the people maybe that we've lost, or people that have were stymied from proceeding in their process. And, you know, I don't think there's any bad intention in this, other than I think this is God's time for this, for our church. And we now have made some decisions in our legislative body, the General Conference, to become a different United Methodist Church than we were prior to the postponed 2020 General Conference that was held in 2024.
I want to come back to that phrase, we're a different church now than we were before General Conference. But let's at least touch on a couple, two other hot button issues and get your take, your take on those, and then we'll conclude with some of these matters of how we're a different church. The areas I'm talking about, revised social principles and the disaffiliation, kind of the ending date for that. Let's take disaffiliation first. You know, there was a process there for churches to disaffiliate, and now that window is closed. Is that my understanding that we're at on that?
Yeah, that there was a provision made in 2019, added to our Book of Discipline, and a paragraph called paragraph 2553 that provided provisions for churches to exit what we could some call a gracious exit if they met certain requirements that had been established by the Board of Trustees. That had a sunset date, meaning December 31st, 2023. Those churches had to have completed that process. So some were coming to General Conference and had been told that we didn't know what would come out of General Conference, if there would be some kind of a extension or new form or new provision for people to exit as a congregation. There have always been people can always leave a church. That's not unique to United Methodism. You know, a member can be a member of a body and choose, because of their own conviction or because God is leading them somewhere else or they've been harmed or hurt, to exit a congregation. But this notion of a congregation leaving the denomination, we weren't designed for that as a denomination.
Right.
So that's why it's not easy to do.
So the effort at General Conference this time to kind of extend that or to change that ruling,
did not pass.
And so that's what I want to be clear about. So the window is now closed for churches to disaffiliate, and we have the old rules of the discipline that apply to any church that wants to follow that pathway, needs to go through.
Yeah,
that
we have. Now, there will be, in our conference, we have a team that's going to be examining the Book of Discipline. And if churches, you know, we had some churches that were didn't meet the deadline, but you know, if everybody in the large percentage of the congregation is already wanting to exit or cease becoming a United Methodist Church, there are provisions in the Book of Discipline for
still,
that.
There's still pathways for them to do that, but the one we had from 2019, that provision
has sunset, everything associated with it has sunset. And I think this is the time really for us to lean in together. I said this before we had disaffiliation, but I think it's a time for United Methodists to really start, not turn inward, but turn outward to our communities, because we are having a shrinking impact on our general society.
Sure.
Because many people look at the church as being totally focused on its current membership and not about current reality.
Well, speaking of leaning into our communities, we're talking about society, and there were some some revision of the social principles. And I know that's got to be close to your heart, because before too long, you're going to be the CEO of the General Board of Church and Society later on this fall. So tell us what happened regarding a little bit of what happened at General Conference regarding the revision of the social principles. How did that shake out? What are the implications moving forward?
Well, the social principles were adopted, all of the changes. It's been a 12-year process, because the General Conference of 2012 commissioned a committee to rewrite the social principles so they could be updated, made more applicable to places outside of the United States. Again, so the social principles can be more applicable to the worldwide nature of the United Methodism, and more succinct. They were so lengthy that most people couldn't get their heads around them. So all of that was accomplished in the new revised edition of the social principles. We adopted an updated social principles with a commitment, Brad, to care for creation, condemnation of racism and tribalism. We support policies that and practices to prevent sexual harassment. We endorse policies to ensure access to clean drinking water and sufficient food nourishment across the globe. We call on church and society to support and advocate for the well-being of all children and young people. That sounds like something that's dear and near to our heart here in Indiana. So the social principles, I think, are a stronger document now. Keep in mind, Brad, the social principles are not law, but they are an expression of what United Methodists believe we should be investing in and advocating for as it relates to the church and our society.
All right, right. Well, it sounds a little bit like Jesus, maybe. What do you think?
Yeah, how about that?
Well, let's bring this conversation around, Bishop, to this. You talk about change. We talked about the process here. We're talking about before General Conference 2024, which is really 2020, and what we are the differences now moving forward. We have said in the past that our mission is the United Methodist Church is to make disciples of Jesus Christ for the transformation of the world. I might ask you, as you come out of General Conference, you said we're different. Are we still, is that still our mission? You know, are we still a church that has primacy on grace? Are we still a church? Are we a church that does have a place for everyone moving forward? Give us kind of the state of the church. What's different now? What do you think as we move forward?
Well, I think this is our opportunity, our season. Bishop Ruby Estrella from the Philippines, she said this in her message to General Conference, Brad. She said, we need to speak more about Jesus. And basically, I think it's a matter of pointing ourselves forward and going on. One of our members here in Indiana said, lay member said, Bishop, we need to go on the offense when it comes to proclaiming the gospel, as opposed to being on the defense about what we are infighting about in terms of our interpretation of scripture, interpretation of the discipline.
We've been on our heels too long, haven't we? We need to lean forward. Okay. Yeah, good. Well, any final thoughts you have, Bishop, that you want to leave with the folks in Indiana and around the world?
There are a couple other things that we didn't touch on. Another episode. You know, deacons.
Oh, okay. Yes.
Deacons now have sacramental privileges, particularly as it relates to the Holy Communion. And I know since I've been a bishop, there's rarely a couple of months go by where there's not a request for a deacon to have sacramental privileges because of their context for ministry, whether it's in a hospice or chaplaincy or jail ministry or serving in a local multiple rural area, and there may not be able. But deacons now don't have to ask permission from their bishop to preside over the sacrament of Holy Communion. Now, some say this maybe requires some further conversation around what do the different orders mean and what are we ordained for and so forth. I always say that the sacrament really is Jesus Christ, and Christ is the one who invites us to the table. So
I think that'll be as a practical matter. I think that will help the sacramental ministry to get closer and deeper into local churches quicker, to be honest with you. And that'll be a good thing. Well, any closing thoughts for us, Bishop, or any other details you want to mention here before we ask you to have a prayer to close us out? And I think we're just beginning this conversation, aren't we? We're going to do a lot of interpreting of the General Conference and other things moving forward. I really want to have a whole session with you sometime about the local church, about how it all applies there. So we can talk about that sometime down the road.
Yeah, 1930. Let me close with this. In 1930, Archbishop William Temple preached at the opening of the 7th Lambeth Conference. And this is what he said. You probably heard this, Brad. He said, this is in 1930. He said, assuring his colleagues, while we deliberate, God reigns. When we decide wisely, God reigns. When we decide foolishly, God reigns. When we serve God in humble loyalty, God still reigns. When we rebel and seek to withhold our service and seek to do it our way, I'm paraphrasing, God still reigns.
God reigns, yes.
The Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, which was and which will come, the Almighty. We can decide however we decide. We can debate as long as we want to debate. God still reigns.
God still reigns.
And to God be the glory. for what God has done, will do, and will continue to do through the United Methodist Church.
Awesome. Can you pray us out, Bishop?
Lord God, we give you thanks and praise for the blessing of love and affirmation for all of God's people. I've said it before, Lord. I learned a long time ago, whether you call yourself light, leaning right or leaning left, we live best when we lean upon the everlasting arms of God. Bless us, O God, that we might not only give thanks for the grace of God, but be extensions of that grace to all people. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. You've been listening to the To Be Encouraged podcast with Bishop Julius C. Trimble. This is the podcast where we offer an encouraging word to an often discouraged world.
Consider yourself encouraged and appreciated for listening to Be Encouraged with Bishop Julius C. Trimble. Now, please share the blessing and encourage others in your life to listen to Be Encouraged. You can do just that by pointing your people to the website tobeencouraged.com. That's tobeencouraged.com. Or connect through Apple Podcast, where you can follow, rate, and review To Be Encouraged with Bishop Julius C. Trimble. When you do that, you're doing your part to bring a good word to a discouraged world. Remember to listen next week to Be Encouraged with Bishop Julius C. Trimble, and never forget, God loves you, and there's nothing you can do about it.